This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiyis Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
This is due to the fact that when we cannot access the community, we cannot perform surveillance activities, including vaccination.
That's Michelle Yao of the World Health Organization on a surge in Ebola cases in the eastern DRC. Details coming up also. Tens of thousands of Algerians boycotted the presidential election yesterday as one candidate claims victory. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Algerians are unhappy on who might replace their former president Bouteflika. Tens of thousands boycotted the presidential election yesterday. They are angry that the presidential candidates are closely linked to the old regime. One of them already has claimed victory. To shed light on the matter, to brief us on the latest election results, I talked to William Lawrence, Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at George Washington University.
Well, we had the lowest turnout since independence in the 1960s, but it was still around 40%. And one of the five candidates won outright. So he won, I think, with 58% of the vote. So about 5 million Algerians of 42 million voted for this prime minister, which is hardly a mandate. And, of course, we did have tens of thousands of Algerians in the streets continuing their protests. We had election headquarters burnt and surrounded by protesting crowds. And we had scuffles in some Algerian neighborhoods well into the night between protests and security forces. So we can expect that the current standoff between the regime and the protesters will continue for some time.
So you're talking about the former premier, Algerian premier Abdelmadjid Tebboune? How about the other four who are actually claiming that victory and say they are going through a runoff at the end of the month?
Well, according to the figures delivered by the regime, there won't be a runoff because he had 58% only. But there were irregularities. About 5% of the polling stations were affected by the protests, and there were closures. And so there's every reason for a full analysis by the authorities of all of the irregularities and closures to see if that would affect that 50% threshold. More importantly, most international news organizations and observation organizations were not allowed to be present on the ground in Algeria and monitoring the polls. So that will make any analysis of irregularities and closures and that and the like much harder to gauge and much more problematic for people to believe because, I don't even think 9 million Algerians voted. All of the anecdotal evidence of polling stations was that very few polling stations passed 15 or 20% participation, but the official rate was 39%. So there are a lot of questions about this election going forward.
Yeah, we're talking about 24 million eligible people to vote and out of that. So are we moving ahead to more uncertainty with protesters calling the election a sham, the old guard still entrenched? What do you see moving forward?
A continuation of what we've seen for 10 months now. Certainly, the main dynamic in Algerian politics for some years now is street action and regime response. The parliament, the political parties, the NGOs have very little to do with this equation. It's a oil and gas rich, rentier regime, which can pay off and buy off protesters to some degree. Mm-hmm. Of course, they want much larger payouts now. But since the population has long learned that street protest is the only way to get anything, this standoff will continue, and we'll continue to see this for a long time, probably this back and forth between street protests and regime responses. What the military would like would be to step back into the shadows where it usually is and have political figures out front, pulling the levers of government. But with such a problematic mandate, it's unlikely that we'll get more stability from this political outcome.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science and international affairs at George Washington University, talking about the election in Algeria. The World Health Organization warns that gains made in tackling the Ebola epidemic in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo are being threatened by ongoing insecurity in the region. As of December 10th, WHO reports 3,340 cases of Ebola, including 2,210 deaths. This represents an overall case fatality rate of 66%. Lishi Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Over the last week, 27 new confirmed cases of Ebola were reported from four health zones in North Kivu and Ituri provinces. The World Health Organization notes this is a substantial increase over the weekly average of seven new cases recorded during the previous 3 weeks. Michelle Yao heads the WHO's on-the-ground operations for the Ebola outbreak. He blames the rise in Ebola cases on attacks by armed groups, which are preventing healthcare workers from reaching vulnerable communities.
This is due to the fact that when we cannot access the community, we cannot perform surveillance activities, including vaccination. That has been one of the key innovations that help us really to stop the spread out of this country toward the others.
Human Rights Watch and the WHO say more than 100 armed groups are fighting in North Kivu and Ituri provinces. Some have attacked Ebola treatment facilities. Since the beginning of the year, eight healthcare workers, including one WHO staff member, have been killed. Because of heightened insecurity, WHO relocated 49 non-essential staff from the Ebola-hit region late last month. When the Ebola outbreak was declared on August 1, 2018, this deadly virus was circulating in 29 health zones, averaging more than 120 new cases of the disease every week. Yao says significant progress in tackling the disease has been made since then. He tells VOA that in the last few weeks, Ebola cases have been reported in only four health zones, Mabalako, Mandima, Beni, and Ocha.
This is actually where we need to ensure access to finish the job. And unfortunately, it's in this area where we are facing insecurity. This area is a mainly rural area. So the big cities, the outbreak is more or less controlled. So we remain with this rural area, but difficult to reach for security reasons.
Yao says he is confident of bringing the outbreak under control if safe access to this area can be ensured. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees and the Swedish Development Agency have launched a $5 million four-year program to promote access to financial and non-financial services to over 100,000 refugees in Uganda. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
$5 million is what will be available to 100,000 refugees in Uganda for a period of 4 years. With pilot projects operating in refugee settlements in northern Uganda, the financial services are geared to help refugees start, build, and expand enterprises to meet their daily needs and be more self-reliant. The Swedish head of development cooperation, Ola Holgren, notes that the program provides incentives for private financial institutions to invest in a target group in which they have previously been reluctant to invest.
There is a lot of unused entrepreneurial capacity that will be realized through this program. By giving refugees access to credit for business activities, supporting startups, facilitating employment, in short, to invest in their own futures.
Uganda is home to 1.3 million refugees, the majority of them from South Sudan and other neighboring countries such as Somalia, Burundi, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Kenya and Rwanda. UNHCR Deputy Representative Marwa Parums reiterated the UN Refugee Agency's commitment to continue to advocate with donors and partners to support refugees. She notes, however, that many financial institutions are still reluctant to lend to refugees because they see them as unstable.
And the fact that we have this program whereby an institution will believe them, will give them the trust that they have lost, and also with the money, they will be able to have a dignified life because they can run their own little business and they will not be able to always ask to be given food.
The project will be implemented by financial institutions, including the Uganda Agency for Development Microfinance. Hannington Thenge, the agency's business growth and development manager, says the refugees should not misunderstand the project, thinking it is free money.
They're expected to appreciate that it's a business, so they have to go through the typical credit requirements. And we are going to enable them to learn all this through business scaling. Those who are business, they will be supported. They will be expected to pay back. So this is sustainable.
80% of refugees in Uganda are women, and in this access to financial services, 70% of the benefits of the program are expected to go to women in farming, handicrafts, catering, and trading. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. It's December and Zimbabwe recently got its first heavy rains. Although delayed, the rains signal the beginning of another farming season, but farmers are facing other problems that could hurt next year's crops. Reporter Kudzai Zanawash has more details.
Maive Pijiti is the vice president of the Zimbabwe Commercial Farmers Union. She says, despite the rains, this farming season had a problematic start.
When the season started, it was a little bit difficult because people didn't get their money. Like when they sold their tobacco, some of them, they buy their input after selling their tobacco. But it was a little bit difficult for them to plan because they didn't know what was going to happen.
She says the government's ban on the use of US dollars meant some tobacco farmers were paid the US dollar value of their harvest in the local currency. But the exchange rate has changed dramatically since then. So the money they earned is worthless. And she says companies selling farming supplies, such as seed and fertilizer, are using black market exchange rates.
The companies who are selling their input, they are rating it mostly it's on the black market rate, which is around 20-something. For example, you can get fertilizer, they charge you about $400, $500, $600 on a bag of fertilizer. But that much is too expensive.
Government has a program to subsidize inputs and support farmers. But GT says that program known as Command Agriculture ties up farmers for days with banking and bureaucracy.
And then they introduce the command, which is supposed to, you have to go through the bank. It's a long process which takes a lot of time. And farmers go to the bank several days without any success. And then by the end of the day, when they are lucky, most of them, they've managed to get the food. But fertilizer, chemicals, they haven't got.
GT says farmers this year have had to plant late without any fertilizer, which will mean far smaller harvests. GT says it's not clear if farmers will make any profit on their next crop. She says fuel prices have also made it expensive to be in the farming business. And given climate change, she says there is extra uncertainty about whether the rains will last the full season or not. Zimbabwe's farms once not only fed its own people, they produced vast amounts of export foods. But years of mismanagement, soaring inflation, and shortages of fuel, fertilizer, and currency have sharply reduced the harvests. Last month, the United Nations said the country faces man-made starvation. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinawashe from Harare.
Freweni Mabratu was named 2019 CNN Hero of the Year. She produces a patented reusable menstrual pad for girls in her native Ethiopia, where menstruation is a taboo. VOA Salem Salomon has her story.
Froweni Mabratu remembers when she returned to her home village in northern Ethiopia and saw women squatting over holes in the ground. Without any sanitary pads to use during their menstrual periods, they were stuck in this undignified position.
How is that possible? And they were telling me that they don't even use underwear. And that was the most turning point for me. I kind of felt, you know, the nerves going from head to my toes. And that's when I said, you know, I've got to do something. Why is this thing bothering me over and over again? So that was it.
The more she examined the problem, the bigger it appeared. 2 out of every 5 girls have been forced to miss school during their periods, with many eventually dropping out. Grown women were resorting to using old cloth or grass as pads. Women and girls, she found, were being shamed by their community during their menstrual periods.
We're talking about always gender equality and all that stuff, but when the basic necessity of a young girl is not fulfilled, how is that possible? Mm-hmm. How is that possible? Mm-hmm. How is the country even going to be developed when 50% of your society, women, are compromised this way?
In 2009, Froini founded Mariam Saba Products Factory in Ethiopia's northern city of Mekele. The factory produces reusable pads that can last up to 18 months and cost 90% less than disposable pads. Froini has teamed up with a charitable organization, Dignity Period, and together they have distributed more than 150,000 free menstrual hygiene kits produced by the factory. The work is having an impact. Dignity Period has recorded a 24% increase in attendance by girls in schools where they offer services. This month, Froini was selected as the CNN Hero of the Year and will receive $100,000 to support her work. She said the award was an affirmation of a decision she made years ago to move, along with her 3-year-old daughter from the U.S. back to Ethiopia to pursue this cause. Today, her daughter is 18 and going off to college.
You know, it was the moment an amazing journey, and people thought that I was crying because of the whole event. But it's the whole timing issue was just, it must have been God's willing to happen the way it happened.
But she says her work is not done. She noted that there are 30 million women of reproductive age in Ethiopia, and the vast majority do not have access to affordable sanitary pads. Additionally, there is a 15% value-added tax on many menstrual hygiene products.
It's not just Ethiopia, it's everywhere, developing countries. Even in the U.S., there is a tax issue. So we seriously, now that CNN has made it an issue that for anybody to look at this seriously, and we hope that everyone will make a sensible solution and a sensible change in making this a reality for all.
Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
After years of preparation and planning, the National Basketball Association is creating an elite 10-team professional basketball league on the continent of Africa. The Basketball Africa League, or BAL, will have its own playoffs and will help develop talent for the NBA with camps and other resources for talented grassroots youth. The BAL's inaugural season, which is scheduled to begin in March, got off to a soft start in Brooklyn, New York last week when the NBA hosted 50 top African players for training and potential recruitment. VOA's Adam Phillips met up with Ghanaian-born John Manuplang, the NBA's head of strategy and planning for the BAL at the event.
The BAL is the new Basketball Africa League that the NBA is launching across the continent. And it's really meant to be the elite club competition for the continent and really the beachhead for the NBA's expansion into the continent. We've been on the ground there since 2010, opened up our office in Johannesburg, and we've built grassroots infrastructure. We've worked with federations, really built a foundation for the business and the sport across the continent, and now the next evolution of that is the Basketball Africa League.
So there must be a lot of different motivations for that. One, some of it must be business. I mean, there's a lot of talent out there, make some dough, and at the same time, there's something else going on.
Yeah, so I mean, look, there's always a why to what we do, right? And I like to sort of tell a story. One of our programs, Basketball Without Borders, where we bring in the top kids under the age of 19 from across the continent. We bring them into a camp, and then they go through life skills training and so forth and so on. At one of those sessions, a young Egyptian kid stood up and asked the question, what happens to those of us that don't make it? And what he meant was, if I'm not selected and plucked out of the continent and moved to Europe or to the US, then I'm not successful. And for us, that meant there isn't a pathway on the continent, a true opportunity for kids to grow up, like the sport of basketball, develop in that, because there's no premier elite league. So we felt it's our responsibility to create that and to create that opportunity there.
Would you say anything about the culture of basketball sort of kind of in the heart in Africa and as it's developed in terms of the spirit of the game and contrast it maybe with the American model? I mean, to the extent that it's not just a global operation, but they bring different things to it, different attitudes, different culture, maybe different skill set.
You know, basketball is truly a global sport, and the NBA is a global brand. And, you know, when you look at the diversity of the people, the cultures, the attitudes that the NBA embraces, yes, there's some American cultural attitudes and so forth that we bring to it, but every single person here who is either from Africa or other places, we embrace that, you know, and all of that contributes to what makes the NBA such a dynamic brand.
Yeah. I was thinking, you know, like, yes, it's a global game in the sense that people all over the globe play it, and over much of the globe play it very, very well. But at the same time, there's a very sort of specific mode or style that you might see in Ghana or Senegal or Nigeria that you wouldn't see necessarily here in the U.S. because maybe there's more of a team spirit, more of a communitarian ethos as opposed to the individualist thing. So I'm just wondering if you have a comment about that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like those kinds of trends fluctuate over time, right? So there was a time when there seemed to be a distinction between how Americans play and how Europeans play, right? Then Dirk Nowitzki comes in, right, and he brings a certain aspect to it. Now, there are so many American players that have modeled their game after him, right? So now, is it European basketball, American basketball, or is it just great international basketball with influences from America, from Europe, from Asia, and everywhere? And that's what really makes it global. And we embrace that 100%.
That was John Manuel Plang, the NBA's head of strategy and planning for the Basketball African League. He spoke with VOA's Adam Phillips in Brooklyn. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, PJ Elliott, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.